teens who survived a shooting at their school in South Florida march on Tallahassee demanding changes to Florida's gun laws. More surprising turns this week in that potential sale of JEA. And are you ready for some football at TIAA Bank Field? Does that roll off the tongue? I don't know. Some of the stories making headlines this week. Good Friday morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. And thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross, and we are always live at 9. Also, make sure to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, and our WJCT app. Just ahead, all of the top stories of the week with our Friday roundtable. You can get on the line now at 549-2937. Then later, it's a look ahead to Extravaganza at Douglas Anderson School of the Arts. Plus, best-selling author Amy Chua on her new book, looking at the nation's political tribes. All of that ahead. But first, it's Friday and time to discuss a busy news week as we welcome Andrew Pantazzi, reporter for the Florida Times-Union. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa.
Claire Goforth is here. She's editor at Folio Weekly.
Good morning.
David Cotton, who writes for the Financial News and Daily Record.
Good morning.
And our own WJCT contributor and board member, Charles Griggs.
Good morning, Melissa.
Good morning, everybody. Thanks so much for being here. So much to talk about this morning. Gosh, a lot happened this week. Everything from new controversy around the possible sale of JEA to a new president at UNF to a new name for the stadium where the Jaguars play. We'll talk about it all. But our top story this morning, dozens of students from Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School marched on Tallahassee this week demanding stronger gun laws to help prevent another tragedy like the one that saw 17 of their colleagues or fellow students and teachers killed after their fellow student Nicholas Cruz opened fire at the school. The legislature this week refused to allow a vote on an assault weapons ban as the students watched and some cried. But at the same time, they did vote to call pornography a public health risk. At Wednesday's CNN town hall meeting, a man named Fred Gutenberg, whose daughter Jamie was one of the students murdered by Cruz, confronted Senator Marco Rubio on his opposition to an assault weapons ban. Listen here.
Now, I think what you're asking about is the assault weapons ban.
Yes, sir.
So let me be honest with you about that one. If I believed that that law would have prevented this from happening, I would support it. But I want to explain to you why it would not.
Senator Rubio, my daughter, running down the hallway at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas, was shot in the back.
Yes, sir.
With an assault weapon. The weapon of choice.
Yes, sir.
Okay? It is too easy to get. It is a weapon of war. The fact that you can't stand with everybody in this building and say that, I'm sorry.
It was a tough crowd for Rubio at that town hall. Still, though, he showed up, unlike Governor Scott and President Trump, who were invited to take the stage along with Senator Nelson and South Florida Congressman Deutsch. We're also learning this morning that the only armed sheriff's deputy at a Florida high school where those 17 people were killed took cover outside rather than charging into the building. This according to the Broward County Sheriff. The deputy resigned yesterday after this news was made public. We're going to begin the hour with a closer look at the student activism from South Florida and the pressure they're putting on state lawmakers and national ones. The number to join us, 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online, send your emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJax. You can also weigh in on our First Coast Connect Facebook page. Claire Goforth, let's begin with you. And right away, before we get any calls, we will not entertain any discussion that these students were paid actors, which has taken hold in some quarters of the internet. Let's just, we're not discussing that because it's absolutely absurd. Let's move on and discuss the fact that these kids got on buses and went to Tallahassee and tried to take part in the political process and are now leading this national conversation.
Yes, I mean, it's another chapter in a long history of student activism and youth-led activism that's trying to move the needle on an issue that's very important to the majority of Americans. I mean, you can say what you want if you support Second Amendment rights, but the fact is most people also support Second Amendment rights, but they support a ban on these assault weapons that are extremely deadly. And what sense does it make that an 18-year-old who can't rent a car, who can't buy a beer, can go in and buy an assault rifle? That just doesn't mesh to me.
We're learning so much as the week has gone on about what happened at the shooting event and how legislators have responded. Watching the town hall, I don't know how many of you watched it Wednesday night on CNN.
Yeah.
Charles Griggs. Andrew David. That was a riveting few hours of television, and I think it was a very uncomfortable evening for Senator Rubio. At the same time, as the evening went on, He appeared to become more open to evolving on some of his positions on this issue.
Yeah, I think it was a bit of an interesting. I mean, it was definitely worth watching, getting to see these students, these teachers, and these parents who've all lost loved ones in this moment. But it was interesting to see the way that the politicians were responding. Senator Rubio, Senator Nelson, in particular, more than Representative Deutsch, treating it at times more like a debate on the topic. And you could see how that was not going as well as the participants had hoped. So you would see the clip you just played was a parent who lost a child who was asking a pretty direct question, and the initial response was not answering the question, and then finally there was an answer. And that kind of what works in politics was not working there, because a lot of times we talk about this in an abstract level. What legislation do you think would be most effective? Whereas these people were talking about actual loved ones who died in front of them or died right after they had.
It looks like these politicians were operating without the confines of their secure environment that we normally see them operate in. And typically what they do is to have debate on issues, and they're informed about opposing viewpoints and so forth. But they had to deal with the optics of emotion that was fresh from the tragedy that happened last week. So in doing so, you're faced with really having to deal with real issues in how your policies you believe in, and policies like Senator Rubio said, he took money from the NRA because they believe in his agenda. Well, then you have to be confronted with what your agenda is and how you're going to move forward with that agenda. And I think that, like Melissa said, even though Senator Rubio seemed to be bending somewhat to some of the words that were coming out, some of the emotions and some of the ideas, it's still a long way off to see some real change here, because there's a lot of work to be done. And I think most of these students and parents just wanted to know that something would be done.
That was a key moment in the program when the student Cameron Caskey stepped to Senator Rubio and said, "Can you tell me you won't accept a single donation from the NRA?" And Senator Rubio deflected that question. That has resulted in a deluge of heat for Senator Rubio. But it's a simple fact of the matter that if you are a Republican running for office in America, if you do not accept money from the National Rifle Association, your primary opponent will. Well, so this is an issue that I think is going to continue to become one that we're going to watch unfold throughout this year, because I think what you're going to see, David Cotton, our business reporter, is increasing pressure placed on companies that do business with the National Rifle Association. For example, if you are a member of the NRA, you get benefits. Like, say, if you're a member of AAA, there are companies that do business and have ancillary partnerships with the NRA. Those companies are now going to be pressured to drop those partnerships.
And we saw that this morning as well. A lot of rental car companies have said that they are no longer going to partner with the NRA anymore. I think also when you see that the voters are going to push this issue to, push this issue in another direction. You know, these businesses, of course, don't want to lose business. I think another thing that is, when we talk about Governor Scott not being there, you know, he's all but certain going to run against Bill Nelson for that Senate seat. And, you know, Marco Rubio struggled a little bit. Imagine Rick Scott being up there. I think we've all covered Rick Scott in media gaggles. He's not the strongest politician when it comes to that. He was sure enough not going to stand up there and go toe-to-toe with Bill Nelson.
He did do a series of workshops earlier this week that were streamed online for people to watch. So that was his response to this. Claire.
Oh, great. Some workshops online in a controlled environment. How very helpful to know what you really think. But, I mean, the NRA and weapons manufacturers, let's not kid ourselves, they don't care about the Second Amendment. All they care about is money. And they use these tragedies to sell more weapons. That's just that continually happens after a tragedy like this. They ramp up their marketing and people start buying more weapons because they're marketing based on fear. You're afraid that you're going to get shot, so now you need a weapon. And now we're all armed, and these arguments that start in a verbal confrontation maybe would have become a physical altercation with fists become deadly involving firearms. I mean, that's just a necessary reaction that's going to happen if we're all armed all of the time.
And also look at some of the policy recommendations that are coming out of the debates that are happening now. I mean, you know, the president had his one idea of, you know, literally sort of arming all or making it possible to have teachers armed. That's been getting a significant amount of pushback. And, you know, the future policies that you see potentially coming out of the Florida legislature, if they do anything at all, you know, though they're going to have to be held accountable not only to the students, but the entire, you know, the voters in the state of Florida. And a lot of these students are going to be voting in the next election. You know, a lot of these students are going to be registering early enough to vote.
The question, though, is in the past when these incidents have happened, they spike up and then they fade from public view until the next tragedy. Is this an inflection point in this long-running, festering wound, frankly, in our society? Is this an inflection point?
I really don't know that we're going to have an answer to that. And I do think something that Senator Rubio said that does seem accurate is the idea that there's not going to be one sweeping legislation that handles these, that if there is anything done, it's going to be done almost piecemeal. One of his early answers to a question was whether he supported, I think it may have been the background check question, where he was talking about needing to beef up background checks and potentially even looking at HIPAA laws to give more access to mental health information. And the student, the child, said that sounds like just one small step. And his response was that, yes, that is just one small step. And I tend to think that's more probable that we see that happened. And I'm also curious what we see in the state legislatures. Unlike in Congress, state legislatures do get legislation passed.
And there are a few states that have what are called red flag laws now, where if someone has been like a Nicholas Cruz and they've displayed violent or disturbing behavior, a red flag is placed on that individual so that they can't get their hands on a weapon. But only a handful of states have done that so far.
It looks like the students and many of the activists are not asking for, you know, like a one big piece of sweeping legislation. People want thoughtful debate and then some type of action. You know, they want the process to work in a situation like this, because we've taken action on so many other issues when tragedies have happened. We've taken action on small issues. Melissa, you mentioned the porn law that they passed. You know, why can't there be thoughtful debate on this issue and then some action taken, and so that people can feel safe?
Well, I think also you saw these kids got a firsthand chance to see sort of the harsh realities of trying to move legislation through. I mean, they go to Tallahassee just to see the House not even take up the topic.
Yeah.
Hopefully that galvanizes them to vote when they are of age and to actually make that change through their, you know, elected officials.
And I think something else that will be key to watch this fall is I would agree that I don't think the NRA's power does come from its money. I think it comes from its virtue signaling. I think that when you get an NRA endorsement, particularly in a primary, what you are getting is a signal to people that you don't just stand on gun rights, but that you stand on a slew of conservative issues. And it becomes this sort of virtue signaling, you know, that the NRA endorsed candidate is going to, you know, stand for the X, Y, and Z, even though what the NRA is lobbying for doesn't mesh with what a large majority of not only all voters, but even a majority of Republicans stand for on some of the minute policy details.
And even a majority of gun owners.
Yeah.
No, polling shows. And by the way, let me just jump in. We've just received an email blast from the governor's office. At 11 a.m. today, Governor Scott will announce an action plan to make major changes to help keep Florida students safe, including school safety improvements and how to keep guns away from individuals struggling with mental illness. That's coming up at 11. Let's go to a few calls, though, now here on our Friday Media Roundtable. Chip is in St. Augustine. Hi, Chip. Thanks for holding. Good morning.
Yeah, good morning. Couple of quick comments. One, arming teachers are the most ridiculous thing I've ever heard. There are so many inert problems with that that it's just ridiculous to even consider it. Second, it's time to get into the streets. The kids are showing us how to do it now. They're calling out our elected officials, and the elected officials are right to be scared of these people because in the few years they're going to be voting, and they've already expressed how they feel. And we as adults, we did it pretty well when Trump was first elected and with the Women's March movement, but we need to do it again. We need to get in the street about all kinds of stuff and call your representatives, call your political leaders or so-called leaders, excuse me, and then everybody get out and vote. One last thing. There are more Democrats than Republicans. All we need to do is get out and vote. Can we please do this? That's pretty much my comment.
Thanks for the call. Akil on the west side. Akil, your thoughts.
Hi, good morning. I have a quick question. You know, most of the Republicans believe in the Second Amendment as being the right to bear arms. And they also believe that it's not a living document. So therefore, you know, it should be applied to the arms that are available back then when it was written, as opposed to what's available now. And number two, I'd love to see how the president defends the fact that if there's a teacher in the class with their handgun, with somebody else coming at them with an assault rifle, with the bump stock, firing 60 rounds a minute, and a teacher's going to defend the class with that, I just don't understand how that's even possible. But thank you for taking my call.
Right. You know, and as you mentioned, Charles, there's a lot of pushback to that already. Here's an email from Marilyn. So much for the president insisting that a crazy shooter would not go to a school with an armed school resource officer. You know, obviously, everyone feels as though we need to better protect the children. But what has been so dismaying to learn is that this school had an armed school resource officer, a sheriff's deputy, and he didn't go inside as the shooting rampage was going on. He stood outside.
I mean, that's quite shameful. I would like to add to some of what the callers and my esteemed panel has said. Most people do believe that the Constitution is a living document, and there are reasonable restrictions on all of the rights that are guaranteed therein. I mean, there are restrictions on the freedom of the press. There are restrictions on freedom of speech, on due process, and there can be reasonable restrictions, and are some, on the Second Amendment. I can't go and buy a nuclear weapon. I mean, that's not legal. So we have to ask ourselves, what do we want the Second Amendment to mean to us today? Obviously, it's something quite different than it meant in the late 1700s because of the variety of weapons that are available. What is the greater right here? The right to human life or the right to have these deadly weapons?
Well, you know, another point that this caller talked about is, you know, arming teachers is probably not the best idea. I have several friends who teach here in Jacksonville, and they don't want money for guns. They'd rather have money for school supplies and for after-school programs and things like that that they can really use. So I think that's one of the big concerns that I keep hearing from my friends is all of a sudden we have money for guns. Where's all the money for our supplies and things like that?
I would add to that, another talking point that has come up has been a continual emphasis, and this has been happening since Sandy Hook in 2012, where we've heard a lot of Republicans talking about mental health, but Florida still lags behind almost every single state in the country in mental health funding, to which if mental health is focusing on mental health is an answer, then that requires funding. That requires an actual being willing to put up dollars, being willing to support the resources that are necessary. And I would still say that plenty of these things are not necessarily directly connected to mental health issues. Not all of these.
Once that point was made, you really haven't heard much of them, more of a discussion about funding mental health, additional funding to help fund mental health, because now you'd have to take action on that as well. So
another point that hasn't been discussed nearly enough, I don't think, and I think, Claire, you touched on this in a recent piece you wrote, is that so often with mass shootings, it's not necessarily a mental health issue, but often it stems from a man who has issues with women.
Domestic violence.
More often than not, men that carry out these shootings have had a prior record of domestic violence and misogyny. And that is a common thread that runs through the majority of these shootings. And so I honestly think that that is being glossed over.
And
even this kid that did this shooting in South Florida, part of his rage stemmed from the fact that he had been dumped by a girl.
Yeah.
And so this is something that as a country, we have really not wanted to really face squarely. The misogyny that's behind a lot of these shootings, frankly.
Yes, I mean, that's such a complicated question. And that's why it's easy to say, let's just ban assault rifles or let's have some more spending on mental health. Those are both excellent and necessary moves that we need to make as a society. But what do we do about the inherent misogyny that many young men, not a majority, I would say, but there's a very large number of young men who are, they feel disenfranchised, they feel angry, and somewhere along the way, that morphs into this idea that by going out in this blaze of glory in their minds, that somehow they'll become immortal, they will become special or famous. I mean, the human mind is such a complicated thing that there's no easy answer.
Some people may argue that how different is that from someone who commits, I wouldn't say ordinary, but a murder like we saw, here earlier in the week, someone who does a drive-by. What state of mind are you in when you commit a drive-by or you murder someone on the street? Are you having mental issues then? Can that be attributed to something that happened in your life, 7, 8 years ago?
Childhood trauma.
Some type of trauma. So, this is a very, sticky situation where if every time we have an active shooter situation, we're going to blame it on a mental health issue. You could sort of open that up, but not always. You can open that up to all types of issues.
And a lot of people are waiting on hold because obviously this is an issue of great importance to all of us. But we do need to move on and touch on some of the other headlines from the week here on the Friday Roundtable. As we move along, the number to join us is 549-2937. And we want to touch on this story. A trail of emails that was made public Wednesday seemed to show that Jacksonville city leaders might have been working for some time on their plans to sell JEA. News for Jax first reported this, that the city council auditor sent an email asking why the city was seeking bids to find a company that could field offers for city assets. Now, JEA is a city asset. The auditor got wind that the city was seeking these proposals and began raising red flags about it, suggesting the RFP seemed to go outside the normal bidding process. However, Jacksonville Mayor Lenny Curry denies that and says these queries were not related to selling JEA. At the same time, City Councilman John Cressenbeny unveiled legislation last night that would give voters a say, a voter referendum on selling JEA. Would come about after a long process looking into privatization. So give us a call, everybody. Would you vote on this referendum up or down to sell JEA? 549-2937. David Cotton, City Council Auditor Kyle Billy, who wrote this email that was made public, is standing by it, even though he was reprimanded for it.
Yeah, catching a lot of heat from the mayor's administration. But, Council President Brochet said after the meeting, and Garrett Dennis, another council member, said during the meeting that they appreciate his inquisitiveness, looking at this as someone who is tasked with protecting the interest of council. And I think one thing that Cressenbeny said, because the question was asked, is it okay for the city to be retaining Public Financial Management, the same company who presented this financial audit of JEA, the same company that JEA has used as a consultant since 2002. Cressenbeny said, we can piggyback off that contract because they are an independent agency. But yeah, Kyle Billy is catching a lot of heat from the administration, but I will say that he does have the support from the city council president and probably a majority of the city council.
The argument from the other side of City Hall is, well, this RFP is general. We are looking into all sorts of ways to privatize infrastructure.
Really? Because I don't really see anything any action on that front. Are we about to sell, I don't know, Jacksport or the bridge? I mean, the mayor's office on this has been anything but transparent, no matter what they say. And everybody sitting at this table knows that they have this top-down approach. They run City Hall, or have attempted to run City Hall, with an iron fist. And that was effective for the first couple of years, and it is no longer effective. City Council is starting to push back, and as they should. JEA is the largest asset that the city of Jacksonville owns. So does it make sense to start with the largest asset? And then first we hear about this offer to top employees, and then we hear about this RFP for a company to help usher through a sale of some sort of assets. We're not sure what they are, according to the mayor's office, when even one of the respondents referred to JEA specifically.
And let's just point out, a retired JEA employee leaked this information. Full disclosure to our listeners, Claire Goforth, your spouse,
yes.
Your husband is an employee of the utility.
That's correct, yes.
So we need to disclose that. Andrew.
I do think this is something really worth conversation. The mayor's administration says that this is connected to the possible privatization or monetizing or partnering on existing or new parking garages, airport, seaport, bridges, roadways, and various other city public infrastructure. So I do think that is very important if we're talking about potentially privatizing the bridges or privatizing the interstates. What does that mean to people who drive on those? What does that mean for people who use the airport? I know that a lot of people are grateful for the very low parking costs at JAX, especially whenever we go out of town to go to another airport where it's something like $20 a day to park.
That's right. That's right.
But if that is the genuine explanation of the mayor's administration, that this had to do not with JEA, but instead the mayor's administration is actually looking at privatizing beyond JEA, but whole swaths of city public infrastructure, including things like Jacksport and the airport. I don't know that that comes across as less hasty or more measured, but rather maybe that we are looking at privatizing a lot of what the city owns.
Yeah, I think if this is the mayor's plan for how to consider these types of deals or these types of proposals, then perhaps that information should be put on the table up front to say, we're going to have these discussions. Don't be alarmed if you see this type of information. And we'll keep you abreast of that. From the council members I've spoken with have indicated that they were completely surprised when they saw this information. So, to Kyle Billy's credit, he's doing his job. And that happens all the time. He catches this kind of stuff all the time. He's supposed to pull these little needles out of the haystack and inform his bosses. He doesn't work for the administration, so he doesn't have any fear there.
He did get an email, though, from, was it Mike Weinstein, saying, I am so disappointed in you.
Yeah, and Sam Moussa said basically the same thing, a little bit longer in his response. And to your point, Anna Brochet told us yesterday that it makes her question what other contracts the city is doing that, either city council is not aware of or the general public is not aware of, because there's obviously a communication problem between these two parties right now. I think, she's sort of been the poster person here for, pushing against the mayor's office. But I think that extends to everybody else on council, too.
Yeah, but that can be dealt with. You got a council president who is, who's trying to be council president and a strong mayor. Right. Mm-hmm. So they can work this out if they want to.
Well, and if not, there's a council election coming up here.
3 months.
They can just wait it out and see who's,
is
next
Aaron
up.
Bowman going to push back?
Well, I would imagine that given the you know, the atmosphere that's going on now, people want to see progress. Mm-hmm. And so if I were in the mayor's office, I would probably start to try to work, you know, work alongside or work with the next council president or the candidates for council president to see, you know, how we can best try to move things forward or work on, a, you know, have a better relationship, you know, going forward for next year, because this does not help progress.
Here's a tweet from a listener. The mayor promised to do a cost-benefit analysis for the public whenever these types of things would be considered. Has that been done?
Well,
they could argue
was it an evaluation or was it an evaluation?
That's the thing, too. I mean, we're still not clear on that.
Hearing about whether or not the presentation by PFM was an evaluation or evaluation. To me, it sounds like a sales pitch to sell JEA, honestly. I do think that it's important to note the timing of this particular RFP, because if this had nothing to do with JEA, then why did it go out right almost a few weeks after mm-hmm. Tom Pettway said, hey, maybe we should privatize, which I find really interesting. One man, given that he's the board chair, he decides to resign and simultaneously say, let's consider selling JEA. And then all of this happens subsequently. Was his word just Tom Pettway's decree that we, and now we all have to
Speaking
do it?
Speaking of the board, here's another tweet. I think the entire board, executive and VP of JEA should be replaced, and oversight should not remain with the mayor's office. They've abused the public trust, and there is no reason to believe their motives have the city's interest at heart. How can the board be replaced? Well, the mayor's office is in charge of boards and commissions. So the person that tweeted me that, there's your answer.
Well, and Garrett Dennis has sort of almost stopped short of saying, you know, Mr. Howard, you know, has not done a great job. He should probably step down. To which Mr. Howard said, Alan Howard, the chair of the JEA board, said, well, you know, he's, you know, he has a right to his opinion. I think for us in the media, I think one of the next steps is, you know, making some public records requests on seeking any information about any of these, you know, possible sales of public assets and things like that as well.
All right. Speaking of presidents, public assets, and changes. UNF has a new president.
A-plus transition, Melissa.
Oh, thank you. All those years in TV news were good for something. You learned how to do segues. And guys, help me out here. How do you pronounce this guy's name?
I was hoping you would
David,
tell us.
David. I believe it's David.
Mr. President.
David Szymanski will lead the school.
We'll take it.
David Szymanski leads the school. He is the dean of the Carl Lindner College of Business at the University of Cincinnati. During his opportunity to speak to the students on campus, Szymanski said he wanted to spend some more time providing experiential learning at UNF. He succeeds the retiring John Delaney, who has been president at the school since 2003 and has grown UNF significantly, both in terms of fundraising and academic programming. And so it's a changing of the guard at UNF.
And I think this man is going to continue that legacy of fundraising and building up the campus. You know, he was particularly strong at that at his time at Cincinnati as well.
I think what's interesting about this is contrasting what we've had. So we had John Delaney come in right after he left mayor's office. John Delaney, a former prosecutor, former general counsel, and then mayor. He was not an academic. And similarly, we see at FSU, John Thrasher, former state senator, again, a politician, not an academic. And there was a role there where they were able to use their both lobbying skills in Tallahassee, as well as the partnerships they had created just with political fundraising to transfer that over to the academic setting. Here we see a more traditional academic background coming in as president. And
right.
So how will that be different for UNF? Will there be a change in going from someone who has a political background to an academic background?
Well, I would imagine that they would probably, the board is probably going to make sure that he's equipped with those local tentacles to help him get adjusted fairly quickly.
Yes, definitely. And one more note from the week, Jacksonville Jaguars fans will still be taking it to the bank this fall, just not EverBank. Yes, it's now TIAA Bank Field. Just in time.
You can still lock down the bank
for
though,
the new season.
Yeah,
oh
new
wait,
the
serene and majestic Michelle Corum is holding up a sign. Yes, I see it. It says
TIAA.
There you go.
Bank Field. It doesn't roll off the tongue, does it?
Guys, I hate to be David Downer here. But
be David Downer.
This is not a sports story. This is a business story. Yeah. TIAA Direct purchased EverBank, one of the last homegrown banks in Jacksonville. And it's like, this is the first thing we get. They've been telling us for months they're going to change this name, and they're going to, and they, you know, hid behind, well, we're researching this, and all of a sudden it's TIAA Bank.
Why not Gator Bowl?
Right.
I'm surprised they haven't changed it before now.
Well, what's ironic is the stadium is not going to be the first thing that they change.
Yes.
They haven't gone before the DDRB board, the Downtown Development Review Board. They have to change, you know, their Bay Street sign first.
Right. Yeah.
Sorry,
well,
guys.
I don't know. We're going to have to get used to this, aren't we? TIAA Bank Field.
We'll leave it to the marketing professionals to make it roll off your tongue.
That's right.
I'll be picketing every game.
There you go.
Well, finally, it's our look at the strange, bizarre, and just plain ridiculous from around the state this week. Luckily, there is never a shortage of material. Here it is for you right now, only in Florida. And we're going to do something a little different this week.
Uh-oh.
Only in Florida do we sometimes have some old-fashioned good news.
Ooh.
Yes. How about that? Now, you may remember local attorney and Jacksonville activist Obi Umuna appeared on this program a couple of weeks ago to raise money to bring young African-American students to see the hit Marvel movie Black Panther.
Wakanda forever.
Well, yesterday, Obi tweeted out that he had raised more than $8,000. So he's going to bring more than 450 students to see Black Panther in Jacksonville on Saturday. And that's our only in Florida story for
that's
the
a good
day.
Story.
Don't go try to see Black Panther on Saturday, listeners. You will not get a ticket.
Jalen Ramsey did the same thing in Nashville, too, over the weekend as well.
Yes. Nice. And all over the country, people are doing the Black Panther Challenge. So congratulations, Obi. And thank you, Andrew Pantazzi, Claire Goforth, David Cotton, and Charles Griggs. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Thanks,
Melissa.
Have a good weekend.
And we'll be right back.
Hear what it means to be Bosnian.
A lot of people from Bosnia was displaced all around the world. A lot of us returned. I was a refugee for almost 9 years.
Update your image of Wales.
Chapel going, coal mine working. That's all gone. It's all in the past. It's a myth.
And enjoy the incredible art of Spain.
It's just what you may expect. A surreal experience
on the next Travel with Rick Steves.
Saturday mornings at 7 on 89.9 WJCT.
She would say to me, come and do a song with me. And I'd say, no. And she'd say, what do you think's going to happen? Am I going to throw rocks at you? And I'd say, yes, something like that.
Join us for more True Stories Told Live. This week, vampires, rock stars, a war reporter, and more. On the Moth Radio Hour from PRX. Saturdays at noon on 89.9 WJCT.
Make an appointment with Public Radio's favorite family doc on the next Zorba Pastor on Your Health. It'll be a jam-packed hour on healthy living, including this tasty recipe for
spinach enchiladas.
We always have a great time. So will you on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRX.
Sundays at 5 on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. In celebration of the arts, Douglas Anderson School of the Arts, DA, proudly presents Extravaganza in beautiful downtown Jacksonville tomorrow night. This show has been wowing audiences for 30 years, and we're pleased to welcome DA Principal Melanie Hammer. Good morning.
Good morning.
Former Principal Jackie Cornelius. She's Executive Director of the DA Foundation.
Good morning.
And Tanner Lane, DA Class of 2009.
Good morning.
Hey, everybody. Melanie, let's start with you. Tomorrow's the big night. What's on the agenda for the show?
It is. We're going to have a great show lined up tomorrow night. We've got Slava, which is an instrumental composition by Leonard Bernstein that's going to be out of this world. We've got our award-winning jazz band playing a toe-tapping number called 2 Seconds to Midnight, and a beautiful, inspiring ballet titled American Spirit, and a whole lot more.
Wow. Now, Jackie Cornelius, of course, you're the former principal. You're now executive director of the Douglas Anderson Foundation. This show has an incredible legacy. And when people go see it, they can't believe these are high school kids.
That's right. It's certainly, to me, the theme is wonderful in that when students are given the opportunity to do what they are best at, it's a great example of that.
Of the talent that's on hand at this school. And full disclosure, I have a child at Douglas Anderson, so I'm a little biased. Now, Tanner Lane, you're a class of 2009. You went on to Florida State. You've appeared in the National Company of Chicago, the musical. You mm-hmm. have starred in the Radio City Music Hall Christmas Spectacular with the Rockettes, among other credits. Pretty exciting for you.
It is.
And so you're here to do a little performing for us as a DA alum, just to give people a sense of this show.
Just a taste. This is a number I'm doing tomorrow. It's What Do I Need With Love from Thoroughly Modern Millie.
And this is a cappella, right?
It is.
Sing a little a cappella for us. Okay, let's listen.
I'm a Joe with just one aim. Every night to date a different dame. Call each one of them the same pet name. Hey, baby. In a row, I have my ducks. Loads of gals to give me loads of yucks. Leave the cooing to the other clucks. I don't mean maybe. Got it good. What do I need with love? I got it good. What do I need with love?
Yay. So you graduated in 2009, but you're coming back to do some performing?
I am.
What had they entice you back?
The vocal director at DA called me and asked me if I wanted to do it. It was actually, I was backstage at Radio City. And of course I said yes. It's something that I've always hoped that I would get the chance to come back and
do. The conquering hero.
So I'm so honored to be able to do this.
What's it like performing with the Rockettes?
The first time it was intimidating. They are definitely a force to be reckoned with, but you're just in awe getting to watch them, and performing in such a historic venue is such a treat.
Sure. Well, Melanie Hammer, principal at DA, you must be so proud of these kids the school is turning out.
I am so proud. They work so hard. They run the show from start to finish, and I just couldn't be happier with what's going to happen tonight. I think everyone will be super impressed.
It's tomorrow night, right?
Tomorrow night.
Sorry. Okay, I just want to make sure. Jackie Cornelius, this is tomorrow evening. Is this the 30th annual extravaganza?
Well, technically, it's really the 32nd one that we've done. And I have to say that the DA Foundation is thrilled to be a part of it, because it's the one time we do the giving from patrons and donors to support the school itself and all the students and what they do.
How can people get, is it too late to get tickets? How can people get their tickets?
According to Melanie, there are still a few left.
There are a few left, and you can get them on Ticketmaster's website.
Ticketmaster.com for the Douglas Anderson School of the Arts, as they proudly present Extravaganza tomorrow night at the school. Music, writing, film, dance, theater, and even visual art. It is an incredible production with hundreds of students involved. So come on out for this Jacksonville tradition. I'm going to be there. I'm looking forward to it.
We're thrilled.
Thanks so much for coming, everybody. Melanie Hammer is principal at DA. Jackie Cornelius runs the DA Foundation. Tanner Lane, DA class of 2009. Where can we see you next, by the way, real quick?
Still working on that. Auditioning in New
auditioning.
York.
Auditioning. Oh, it's an actor's life. It's an actor's life, isn't it?
It is.
Well, best of luck and have a great show. Thanks for coming.
Thank you.
In a moment, best-selling author Amy Chua on the nation's political tribes. That's after this.
The battle is on for better background checks.
I can't answer whether someone has security clearance or not, but I can tell you that nothing will affect the valuable work that Jared is doing.
Who is and is not in the clear with Kelly? And what's next as America's students step up? The Friday News Roundup next time on 1A. Weekdays at 10 after First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
remember me. Though I have to say goodbye, remember me. Don't let it make you cry. For even if
that song from the soundtrack of the film Coco's been nominated for an Oscar. The film has two for Best Animated Feature. On the next Fresh Air, we hear from co-writers and directors Lee Unkrich and Adrian Molina. Join us.
Weekdays at noon on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
I'm Ira Flatow. You know, robots are not just made of metal. Some are soft-bodied, muscly things. This week on Science Friday, robots that take a cue from nature and can heal their own flesh. And new evidence that our long-lost cousins, the Neanderthals, made art. Pretty good at it, too. What does that tell us about how they thought? The answer is on Science Friday from PRI.
Fridays at 3 on 89.9 WJCT.
On the next Jazz Night in America, pianist Eric Lewis, also known as E-Lew, he invented rock jazz, and now he makes his return to Straight Ahead at Jazz and Lincoln Center.
I'm returning undimmed, fury undimmed, technique undimmed, power undimmed. In fact, I got a lot better.
That's on the next Jazz Night in America.
Saturday nights at 8 on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. Well, finally this hour, she first made waves as the best-selling author of Battle Hymn of the Tiger Mother. Remember that book? Man, it caused a stir. Well, now author and Yale Law School professor Amy Chua is back again. And in her new book, she offers a new prescription for both America's foreign policy failures and our destructive political tribalism. Amy Chua is on the line now with more in her book, Political Tribes, Group Instinct, and the Fate of Nations. Amy Chua, good to have you back on the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
This is fascinating because, as we've long known, human beings are tribal creatures and we need to be in groups. We really seek out group identity. But what you're arguing in your new book is that as other nation states kind of cluster in religious or ethnic tribes, here in America, we've really clustered around political identity and identity politics, and that it's gotten really dangerous and toxic. And that's exactly something that you're really writing about, I think, in a compelling way. What concerns you
Thank
about
you.
This?
Well, the fact that humans are tribal is something that we just have to deal with. I mean, it's just a fact. Study after study, it's kind of like we're hardwired to be that way. If you think about sports, it's the clearest case. The problem is that when tribalism takes over the political system, that's really dangerous because once we connect with a tribe, we just want to stick with it and we will defend it no matter what. You know, so if you're on tribe's team or somebody else's tribe, you will stick with it. And facts start to not matter because you just see things through your group's tribal lens. And this is preventing us from having a national conversation about really important issues. It's fascinating. You can show a group of people the same exact numbers and statistics, and let's say about gun control, and half of them will conclude from those exact same numbers, that's why we need more guns, and the other half will conclude, that's why we need fewer guns. So if we're really going to have these important conversations that we need to have, we need to break out of these tribal mentalities.
Right. And that's easier said than done. Because as you point out, we're seeing this both on the left and the right. And whatever group you belong to, you feel this sense that your group is the one that's being persecuted.
Exactly. So, you know, it's funny that you mentioned Tiger Mom because it seems like I get in trouble for everything I do. But even the reaction to the book, this book is about overcoming political tribalism. And I think both sides of the spectrum aren't going to be happy because I don't pull any punches on either side. I think that both the left and the right are partially to blame for the current political turmoil. You know, on the left, I think there's so many important things that progressives have done, but I think in recent years, the emphasis on kind of identity mongering and victim worshiping and constantly check your white privilege, all this, has really led to enormous resentment, and not just taken over college campuses where I teach, but also contributed to the rise of Donald Trump. But I think the right is equally to blame with all the, you know, rage mongering and the conspiracy theory peddling that just gets people so angry and worked up and scapegoating. That too has broken out of just conservative media, and it is has also contributed to the recent election and the resentment. So I feel like when people write books, the natural tendency now in our political tribes is, okay, which side is she on? Is this a right-wing book or a left-wing book? And then we just either attack it or embrace it. And I'm actually trying to be pretty open.
Okay, and we're getting close to the end of the hour, short on time. I'm getting tweets about this too, saying you at WJCT need to get out of your own tribal bubble. We all can fall prey to groupthink, tribalism. As a society, we've reached, I think, a dangerous inflection point with this. So quickly, what are some ways we can build a national identity that gets us out of this?
Well, two things. First, the good news is that evidence shows that when you can pull people out of their tribal context and have them interact as human beings, you know, like don't talk about politics, talk about dogs or children or, you know, sports. Enormous progress can be made. In the 50s, when they integrated the military, this is a great example. So there are movements all over the country that just don't happen to be on cable news and social media, like this thing called Better Angels or what Sarah Silverman is doing. There are a lot of people who are just quieter who actually are sick of all this anger and this kind of, it's almost like a gotcha game, you know, like whatever you say, gotcha from the other side. The other thing is we have to remember that in order for everybody to buy into our strong national identity, you know, what I say about America is we're special because we have this strong national identity, but we also have allow individual subgroup identities to flourish. Like I'm Croatian American, Libyan American, Japanese American, and yet you can be intensely patriotic at the same time. So we need to make good on both those levels. You know, we can't just keep tearing down the national identity, but we also, in order to make people want to buy in, we have to seem like a legitimate country for everybody and allow individual identities and groups to flourish too.
Amy Chua, we so appreciate you being with us. Important words at this time in our nation's history. Thanks, Amy.
Thank you.
She's best-selling author Amy Chua. Her new book is Political Tribes, Group Instinct, and the Fate of Nations. And that's our show today. Thanks for listening. If you missed any part of today's show, the rebroadcast is on tonight at 8. And don't forget to join us at 1 this afternoon for our new statewide call-in program, the Florida Roundup. 1A is coming up next. I'm Melissa Ross, and you're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT FM Jacksonville, your community, your world. We'll be right back here again at 9 a.m. Monday. Have a great weekend.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.